another session of questions which should primarily relate to the film we've just seen, but obviously may well include some of the issues covered in the previous films.
I want to ask, you know, this thing about arbitrarily making these decisions about killing people. What is the difference between what we're discussing and the related issues of war, where we equally decide that we have the legal right to take the life of another human being?
Fine, thank you. Buddha?
I think it's a good question, but I think the difference is that in a situation of war, you're facing, first of all, the whole situation as an executioner, and as we were saying in the previous discussion period, and secondly, you're facing a person who has made choices that bring with them consequences, just as an executioner is face to face a situation in which a person has made choices for which you confront the person with the consequences of that choice. So I would say it isn't quite the same. It's only the same in the sense that you have to make a decision. But I think in a situation of war, you actually, judgment and punishment in that kind of situation, just as in criminal justice, deals with confronting a person with the consequences of the choice that they have made. Is that the direction you wanted to carry it in?
You've basically got it. Just one qualification there. What about, you see, in modern war, the choice is made, it may not be made by the individual at all. He may not be responsible. He may be there as a conscript, and because the days of volunteer wars have gone now. Hence, it may be the case of his government making the decision for him.
Yeah, but I don't think you're ever free from taking the responsibility for the things that you do, including the responsibility to be a dutiful citizen, because maybe you have the responsibility to object to the conscription. But I think the greater issue is there, where war unhappily also touches people that have not made choices directly. And there we are face to face again with what we've said before, and that is the fallenness of the whole situation, where we have to recognize that nowhere in life is there a just existence between birth and death, unhappily.
Fine. Is there another question?
Gentlemen, a two-part question. We've heard about the right to live. What's your view on the statement that perhaps the human being has a right to die?
I'm commenting as an individual and certainly not as an obstetrician and gynaecologist. This is way outside my field of expertise. But as I read the scriptures, and I accept the scriptures as being the basis in all matters of faith and conduct, that my life comes from God. It is in His hands. My days are written, as it says in the Psalms, in God's economy even before I was born. And so the time of my death is in God's hands and not mine. Therefore, I have no right.
I've heard it said that life is a terminal disease. That is, that we were all going to die. And the difficulties that come with making the decision at the time that you are faced with someone who is having a very difficult death in terms of pain and so on is never any lessened by having to make a decision of to give more or to give less therapy. It is in the same way as we approach abortion, that is, that I judge how long I should treat or not treat in the same context of that person's total human existence with his family and with those who come in contact with him. And in my position as someone who practices medicine before the Lord, and this decision is always individual and always very difficult, and nothing can be right for me in this situation because death itself is so terrible in parting families and one member more of the human race.
What is your view then on perhaps the statement that man, and I'm thinking perhaps mainly of medical people, are perhaps interfering with God's plan by keeping someone alive? I'm not saying I agree or disagree, but if someone has a terminal illness or someone, say, has a heart attack, the medical people step in, resuscitate. You know, was it the Lord calling that person home, or have we interfered by retaining life?
Yeah, I think the whole question you raised in both aspects should be seen in the context of the present cultural climate, in which we have at least three components that we have to consider. And one is the increasing selfishness of the individual in assuming that in fact I do have a right to determine what I get out of life, and when I've had enough I have a right to say, now this is it, as the answers to your first question already indicated. The second thing is that the advances in medical sciences have created, together with the benefits, also a problem. And that is the problem that in fact we can prolong death in the realization that all life is terminal. It isn't just a certain disease that may be terminal, but all life is terminal in the unhappy, broken universe after the fall and prior to the return of Christ. We have a situation in which, because of medical science, we in fact can prolong death. And there we have to have the courage to say, my good doctor, if you want to prolong death, that is your problem for glory, that you have that for you, for the, that you have this problem. But you have to come to grips with the fact that no amount of technical know-how is going to prolong life. You're only prolonging death. And the third thing, unhappily, is that we live also in a society that has other standards than biblical standards to evaluate the value of the human being. We have standards of economics and productivity. We have standards of physical and psychological health. And we have produced, in fact, a climate in which only the young, those whose hands do not get marred by the dishwater soap they use, those who are popular and have many friends and so forth, are seen as leading valuable lives. That is the standard by which, through advertisement and a general mentality, we evaluate the worth of an individual. And thus we often push people into a situation in which they say, I cannot afford to become a burden on somebody else. I will lose my friends who have been my only criterion for human life, and because I've become old or difficult and so forth, and thus I should really die. I think this is the other side of the coin, where we have twisted our orientation to decide what is valuable in human existence from the human and biblical, humane and biblical, as God defines human, to these other criteria that are very much characteristic of our age. And I think this is where we have to deliberately do something against it. In practical terms, as the film also tries to point out, I was interested to hear that in the 60-minute broadcast two Sundays ago, the woman wanted to commit suicide because, in fact, she had become a burden in her own eyes, as she saw it. But she couldn't do it, of course, the Sunday that her nephew called and said, I'm going to come visit you. And it seems to me that that's an indication of some of the disease in our society, that if in fact nephews were willing to visit their grandmothers, or whatever they are, great-grand-aunts or something, and we created a more humane context of life, that then some of the desire to terminate life, to write a living will and so forth, would be less likely.
I wonder if I'd be permitted to make a comment in defence of the medical profession. I'm a doctor of 30 years standing. I happen to be also an honorary physician at the Mount Olivet Hospital for the Incurable Ill and the Dying. And I think that the idea that the medical profession is in actual fact using all its extreme technology to keep people alive willy-nilly, come what may, is in actual fact a bit of propaganda which has been used by those who are purveying the euthanasia mentality. I think Everett Koop made a very clear distinction there between decisions which are based upon the future quality of life of the person and decisions which you make in relationship to the difficulty of your treatment and so on, and decisions which you make which are related to the whether the patient is curable or not. And it can be, in most people's lives, there can be recognised a point where the dying process has set in. And no doctor that I know of, worth a grain of salt, attempts to prolong the dying process. He has moral obligations, however, to provide that person with the ordinary means of care, that is, good nursing, food, liquid. And I think the principles come through pretty clearly. There may be some difficult situations one is caught in, but it's almost invariably by accident, as happened in that case in the United States where the doctors did their best with a girl who'd come in with an overdose of drugs, which I think is good medicine, and then got caught with her on a machine. So that the number of decisions in which that one gets trapped are relatively small, indeed a bit greater than in the past, but I think we should wipe out this concept that the medical profession is attempting in every single case to put in all the tubes, all the resuscitators, all the heart maintenance apparatus, because that just isn't the truth.
Thank you. I think that we would be grateful in acknowledging your attachment and your work. As someone who works in a very large teaching hospital, I would say to you that there are major problems in such decisions, and they're very much problems of individual doctors and their own worldview about life and their technology, and they can't easily be dismissed because there is a tendency to swing one way or other, and we have to be very careful not to just say the problem doesn't exist or to exaggerate it. But I'd to say that all of us live in a real tension in these decisions. As you will know, that it's extremely difficult often to weigh the pros and cons in a given situation. And we should do it as people who have limited understanding, but who look to the Lord for guidance. Thank you.
This question is for Udo. What you said earlier about truth, I've written it down, I'll just read it straight through. If we accept that there is true truth, how does one go about knowing or discovering this truth? To what extent does our cultural background determine our categories of description and indeed our way of thinking and reasoning itself? Having adopted a methodology for arriving at truth, how do we justify the methodology itself?
Udo?
My suggestion is that truth is that correspondence of internal and external evidences which not only agree with the categories of the human mind, but also with the realization that we live in a universe that has its own categorical definiteness, and that definiteness is inescapably there. So, having said all that, I would say that I don't think it's a matter of our cultural context. That is often the the accusation that is raised against us in our Western culture that we're basically antithetically thinking, we're oriented from Greek philosophy, that other cultures look at truth differently. You have a whole school that calls itself black theology in America. I noticed that somebody gave me a pamphlet that speaks of an Australian theology. I think much of that kind of discussion, insofar as it attempts to relate to a particular life situation, is valid, but insofar as it attempts to establish different rationalities for different racial or cultural contexts, I think is inaccurate, because the givens of the definite universe around us, or as Schaeffer calls it, the universe in its form, or the definite given of the human personhood or man in his mannishness, are there wherever, no matter what the cultural context is. And thus I would say, truth on the lowest common denominator is that which is both corresponding to the categories of our mind, as expressed, for instance, in language that is rational, and is in correspondence with the kind of world that we have to live with, no matter what our worldview is, no matter what our philosophy, no matter what our view of truth is. In other words, to bring it down to the common level, it's what's there. So the reason we say that that somebody is telling a lie or living a lie is not because he disagrees with us, but rather he can't live in the kind of world that his thought has established. The reason I'm not a Hindu is because Hinduism teaches that basically all reality is seen to be as illusionary, but I don't find a Hindu who lives with it. The reason I can't be a Mohammedan is because basically Allah is seen as totally arbitrary. I don't find it that any person lives in the universe that's totally arbitrary. The reason I am a Christian is because I find that what Christianity says about reality not only describes the reality for the Christian, but for every human being. So I am inescapably, in other words, let me say it this way, I think the more honest I am with the givens of my day-by-day life, and the more honest I am with that which mankind has always portrayed as real in terms of its own nitty-gritty existence expressions, speaks only one language, and that is the language that we live in a definite universe that has rational categories where truth can be discovered. It's the universe the Bible speaks about that is the creation of a definite God who has a personality, and that's the God of the Bible.
Is there a question? Is there a question from the other side here?
Well, I've been handed a question.
I'm sorry, have you been handed another question?
Yeah.
Thank you.
So the question is to ask you, though, how he knows the truth. Which is, I suppose, what you just explained, isn't it?
Yeah, I basically arrive at truth constantly by trying to integrate thought, which can also be imagination, with the reality or the givens of the world I have to live in, whether I like it or not. And that existence, that is my way of looking at things and the way the universe forces me to live whether I like it or not, raises questions. And I shop around, as it were. That is, I did, and I hope I still do. And I look at all those things that claim to be true, and true explanations. And the more I look over the 20 years that I've been a Christian, the more questions I've had, but also the more answers I've found, and the more wonder I've had in realizing that what the Bible talks about is really true, and this God is really there. So in the context, let's say, of Labrie, which doesn't have anything to do directly with this part of the film, but more with the next part, what we have is a situation in which people know that they can come and raise all sorts of questions, and we will not give them answers either from our experience or merely with reference to faith, but rather show that indeed in the context of human existence, of that which man is in distinction to non-man, there's only one possible answer, and that's the answer the Bible gives.
Yes, we have a question.
Well, this is for you, Dad. Capital punishment for criminals, and for which crimes is capital punishment indicated?
Well, let me divide the answer, if you allow, into two parts. And the one is, the first part is that it is awfully difficult in an increasingly non-Christian culture to give a straightforward answer, because it just depends on what is done with the answer you give and how are people going to read it. And in a situation in which justice is not being maintained, but only legalism, in which compassion is not practiced, but only entitlements are traded, it is very difficult to speak about capital punishment for or against it. And I think that's the kind of culture we all are increasingly more familiar with. On the other hand, I would say, let me give you a yes or no at the end. On the other hand, I would say, it depends so much, the answer to the question depends so much on your view of the human being as a human being. If you say that basically, no matter what you do, you can get away with it up to a certain level, that is up to life imprisonment, and there's nothing that you could do that is worth the termination of your biological existence, then it seems to me what you're saying is that you, criminal, are responsible only so far but not further. I think the biblical view is that as a person I am indeed free to believe a lie and to act on that lie, including the killing of another human being. But what the Bible also says is that as an individual I'm taken so seriously in my significance that the consequence of taking somebody else's life is that I've forfeited the right to my own biological existence. And I say that complicated phrase deliberately because the Bible does not just say casuistically this is where the guy should be hung, but rather it does speak of the distinction between mere biological existence and the kind of existence that God has given us from the point, as I feel, from conception on, and that is that will never end. But then the Bible does say that there are situations in which my choice needs to be taken so seriously that indeed the blood of another person, that one I have killed, should come back on me. Now, let me put it into a practical situation. What court of appeal can a bank robber go to who, for the sake of $10,000 booty or loot or whatever, is willing to kill? Has he not made an expression of the value of human life by saying, I'm willing to kill for $10,000? Now, what court of appeal is he going to appeal to for a higher view of life than the one that he has expressed in his own standards? It seems to me that he has already said that life is worth only so much money. Now why should he say, but my life is worth more? And that's where we're twisted, I think, in our humanistic perspective, that we have a double standard in the name of humanism, and the double standard isn't just there where one person is allowed to die, lose his biological existence for $10,000, and the other person isn't allowed to lose his biological existence for anything. And the other area of the double standard is where, in the name of humanism, we do not take the criminal and his choices seriously. Now, that's not to say that I'm not aware of the need to very carefully examine the degrees of responsibility, etc., 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 etc. I'm not saying that. I studied law, I have a degree in law. But I'm discussing more the philosophical implications, and that is, if I've made a decision that indeed the life of a person isn't worth more than the money I can get out of a heist, then I have nowhere, no one to appeal to for the protection of my life. Now then, I'm not answering all of your question, but deliberately, because we live in a cultural context in which that becomes highly complicated. and in which we're not free, I feel, to just say casuistically, here but not there, here but not there. It's a matter of understanding, where are we going, what must I work towards, and then when the situation is there, we're not only the poor, or not only those who cannot afford a lawyer or a clever lawyer, get hung and everybody else goes free. That is an immoral and unjust situation.
Yes.
I'd like to say too, I really appreciate the films and what stood on them. Now the point is, when Jesus sat down with the sinners and the prostitutes and the publicans, he didn't sit down with them to, and I don't want to sound facetious, but he didn't sit down to show them a series of 5 films and tell them why what they're doing is wrong and to give them a new set of rules. Jesus sat down with them to give them life. The Bible is not a set of rules, is not a view of truth, is not a worldview, it's a book of life.
I'm sorry, do you have a question?
Your comment, please.
Well, I think it would be wrong to get hung up with a 20th century medium and trying to find its justification in the Bible. So let's not talk about whether it's right to use a film or not. That would be my first point. No, just to clarify the thing. But it seems to me the book of life, I totally agree with. But life also, if it is true life, expresses itself in the compassion of caring enough for the other person to see that the point I want to make really gets across. And that Jesus did in every situation he was in, and so did Paul and Peter. Life was not in a vacuum, and it was not a glow. It was the compassionate use of time, of words, of power, of comfort, in whatever the situation demanded, to show in fact that in the universe of such darkness, light exists. In the universe that is so covered with death, indeed, our hope is a hope of life. So let us not then, because of what Christ achieved, assume that we can make a shortcut where Christ expressed his compassion in actually speaking, talking, living, comforting, and healing the person before him. I think it would be wrong, and I think it is part of our shortcut mentality, to forget that what God has given us is indeed the word of life, but the word of life is in no conflict with the word of truth. Remember what Jesus says in John, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And it is wrong to just take one of these because somehow I have experienced something that I attribute to lifeness. When in fact the communication of the word of God is across all areas of life. It is truth, it's truth versus falsehood. It is a way against, it's a way being demonstrated and proposed against the hither and yon mentality of our culture. It is the truth against deception, etc. and so forth. I don't see why we get so hung up with somehow feeling unspiritual or ashamed, because I think often the two things are two sides of the same coin. That maybe we have to sit down and actually talk to the people in the language they understand. Paul did that in Athens, he did it in Lystra, he did it everywhere he preached. He did not have just his presence, he did not have just miracles. No, he communicated out of compassion for the human being. His communication was never just a philosophical discussion, it is true. But neither is this. It is indeed the presentation of the fact that God is there and that he has given us a word that is indeed the word of truth and the word of life.
If I could just come in on that same question, say from my own personal medical point of view and hark back to this morning, I felt rather profoundly unhappy at the end of the session this morning because the question seemed to be on that 1% or few percent of abortions that are really difficult. we do have a problem with abortion, and we quoted the figures of 60 to 100,000 unborn infants are losing their lives in unborn babies are losing their lives in or potential lives in Australia. The problem of infanticide may well come. Our attitudes to the elderly folk may well also become one of a burning problem in our community. It seems to me that the Christian doctor, or the God-fearing doctor with his high view of life, has a strict approach to abortion, has an extremely strict approach to these other things, and for him, euthanasia is out. The session today is showing the situation that comes when we do not have the life of Jesus Christ, that we've got these problems. The solution, it seems to me, in general terms, at the root, is to discover that life in Jesus Christ, and then our view on these other things will alter to a higher view, and so the problem will be dealt with at root cause. And therefore it is valid to have 5 films dealing with this sort of thing.
Yes.
It's been stated by Baishe from the film that these are the fundamental or primary focal issues for the end of the 20th century. But isn't that rather an overstatement? Certainly these are issues, but so many more millions of people are affected by disparity in wealth than there are by these issues of euthanasia and infanticide. And in fact, isn't it dangerous to make that overstatement? Because it will lead to a comforting of Christians and concerned individuals who won't then have to make radical changes in their lifestyles to cope with the more global questions. And my question to you is, isn't that an overstatement? And isn't that a dangerous overstatement, because there are radical changes in lifestyle that need to be made for the more pressing global issues that people have to face at the end of the 20th century?
I don't think it's an overstatement, but neither do I think the film proposes that these are the three areas upon which all our energy ought to be concentrated. The energy ought to be concentrated on the recognition that indeed our whole culture is going the wrong way, which has ramifications in every area of our existence. But why these three are singled out is because you have a peculiar phenomenon of a country like the United States, which claims to have 80 million born-again Christians and yet 6 million abortions a year. And there's something profoundly wrong in a situation where Christians are willing to go along the mentality of the culture that surrounds them, as is taking place. Christ forgives all sins, he'll forgive this one as well, so I can go ahead and do it. And this is there for divorce, this is there for abortion, this is there for these particular things that are spoken of. But I agree with you, it should in no way be limited to that at all. But I think if we begin to see that as a further problem rather than as the only problem, as we see it as an important problem, because here we're discussing something that is not... well, it's sort of at the heart of things, because it's a question of who the human being is. Rather than... Please don't misquote me out of context. In a certain level, on the periphery, where I come to grips with the... Where I come to have to recognize, not come to grips with, but have to recognize the injustice between birth and death alone. The injustice of hunger, the injustice of poor education, the injustice of being exposed to a teaching which is against the individual and against man and so forth, a teaching of darkness rather than a teaching of light. All these things have to be seen in the context as a whole, yes. But in a sense this is fundamental, because it cuts right down to the beginning of the discussion, namely, why should I take care of the poor? Well, because they're human beings. And here we're not even allowing human beings to live. It isn't that we allow them to live and then we don't give them enough food. It is that we don't even allow them to live. And in that sense, it's fundamental. But please don't, and I'm thankful for your widening it, please don't see that as an issue that is the sole issue that Christians ought to concern themselves with.
Thank you.
Just referring to something that Udo said before, I'd like him to explain it a bit more for me. When he said that you can't prolong life, you can only prolong death. What did you mean exactly by that?
No, I didn't mean to say that. What I said was that you'll find a situation today culturally in which you find certain members of the medical profession who are in fact prolonging death rather than prolonging life. There is such a situation as prolonging death because of medical possibilities. And I know, for instance, from the University Hospital in Lausanne, which is a rather large complex, that there are a good number of medical personnel there who find it impossible to speak to their patients about the reality of the fact that they are going to die, who have a subjective hang-up in the area of not being able to come to grips that their technical expertise is not going to save this person. And thus they somehow hope that he will go into a coma and they would not have to explain. Whereas the Christian view is to say, here is a situation in which indeed all medical expertise can be used in order to prolong life. That's why I go to a doctor to begin with, no matter when. On the other hand, there's also a situation in which the technical expertise will not reverse the situation. It is merely prolonging the reality of death. And that's the situation when I, as a Christian, would have to say, my good man, patient, you have to come to grips with the fact that you are going to die. Have you set your house in order? Talk to your family, and how are you going to meet your Lord? And we will try to control your pain, but we're not going to go on prolonging death in an attempt, in the sort of keeping alive an illusion that death is maybe not real. Yes, it is real in a fallen world, and it is horrible and unacceptable, but it is real. So that's what I meant to say. Does that clarify it? Thank you.